Meggy Reddy with an ironic expression on his face. That's what they do. They always go barefoot. Do I have to change for this festive occasion, too? What does one wear to attend an execution? I imagine I will be sitting beside Capricorn. The magpie stuck out her chin. It was a small, soft chin, and looked as if it came from another, gentler face. You can stay as you are, she said, putting a comb with pearls in Meggy's hair. Prisoners don't have to change. The mockery dripped from her voice like poison. What do you mean, prisoners? Fenolio pushed his chair back. I mean prisoners. What else? The magpie stepped back and looked critically at Meggy. That will have to do, she said. It's odd, but with her hair back she reminds me of someone. Meggy quickly lowered her head, and before the magpie could give this observation more thought, Fenolio diverted her attention. But I am no ordinary prisoner, madam. Let's get that quite clear, he roared. Without me, none of this would exist at all, your own less-than-delightful self included. The magpie cast him a final contemptuous glance and took hold of Meggy's arm, luckily not the one with Fenolio's precious words inside its sleeve. The guard will come for you when it's time, she said to Fenolio, leading Meggy to the door. Remember what your father told you, called Fenolio when Meggy was out in the hallway. Words don't come to life until you can taste them on your tongue. The magpie nudged Meggy in the back. Get moving, she said, and closed the door behind them. Chapter 54 Fire. They set out when dusk fell over the hills, leaving Gwyn at their camp. After what had happened on their last nighttime visit to Capricorn's village, even Farid could see it was better that way. Silvertongue made him go first. He knew nothing of the boy's fear of ghosts and other nocturnal terrors. Farid had hidden it from him more successfully than he had from Dustfinger. Silvertongue did not mock his fear of the dark either, as Dustfinger had, and, curiously enough, that made the fear less, shrinking it as only daylight usually did. But now Farid was going to use something else that Dustfinger thought him too foolhardy to handle. Fire. They had decided to start a fire next to Capricorn's house so that it would not spread to the hills so fast but would threaten the only thing Capricorn cared about, his treasure chambers. This time the village was not quiet and empty as it had been on the previous nights, but was buzzing like a wasp's nest. Four armed guards were patrolling the parking lot, and cars were parked all around the wire netting fence that surrounded the former football field. Their headlights bathed the area in glaring light, as if a bright cloth had been spread out in the dark.
So that's where the show's going to take place,
whispered Silvertongue as they approached the houses.
Poor Meggy.
A kind of rostrum had been set up in the middle of this arena, with a cage opposite it. Perhaps for the monster that Silvertongue's daughter was to read out of the book, perhaps for the prisoners. On the left-hand side of the field, facing away from the wire fence and the village, stood long wooden benches. A few of the black jackets were already sitting on them, like ravens that had found a bright, warm place to spend the night. They had thought of stealing into the village from the parking lot. With so many strangers around, perhaps no one would notice them. But then they decided on a longer, darker route. Farid went ahead again, using every tree as cover, always keeping uphill from the houses, until they were above the uninhabited part of the village that looked as if a giant had trodden on it. Even there, more guards than usual were patrolling. They had to keep retreating into the shadows of a gateway, ducking down behind a wall or climbing through a window, and waiting with bated breath for the guard to pass by. Luckily, there were many dark corners in Capricorn's village, and the guards strolled through the alleys with an air of boredom, as men do when they are sure there is no threat of danger. Farid had Dustfinger's backpack with him, containing all they would need to kindle a quick, hot fire. Silvertongue carried the wood they had collected, in case the flames did not find enough to feed on among the stones. and there were Capricorn stocks of gasoline, too. Farid still had the smell of it in his nostrils from the night when they had shut him up in the sheds. The tanks were seldom guarded, but they might not need them. It was a windless night. The flames would burn quietly and steadily. Farid remembered Dustfinger's warning.
Never light a fire when it's windy. The wind will catch hold of it, and it will forget you. It will fan the flames until they leap up and bite you and lick the skin from your bones.
But the wind was sleeping tonight, and the still air filled the alleyways like warm water in a bucket. They had hoped to find the square outside Capricorn's house empty, but as they were about to enter it from one of the alleys, they saw a half-dozen men were standing outside the church.
"Why are they still here?"
whispered Farid, as Silvertongue drew him into the shadow of a doorway.
"The festivities are about to begin."
Two maids came out of Capricorn's house, each with a pile of plates. They were taking them to the church. Obviously, the successful execution was to be celebrated there later. When the maids passed the guards, the men whistled at them. One of the women almost dropped the crockery when one of them tried to lift her skirt with the barrel of his gun. It was the man who had recognized Silvertongue when they slipped into the village the night before. Farid touched his forehead, which was still blood-stained, and cursed him with the worst curses he knew. Why did he have to be the one there? But even if they got past him unrecognized, how were they going to start a fire while the others were still standing around?
"Take it easy," Silvertongue whispered to him. "They'll soon go away. The first thing we have to do is make sure Meggie really has left the house."
Farid nodded, looking at the big house. There were still lights on in two of the windows, but that didn't necessarily mean anything.
"I'll sneak down to the football field and see if she's there," he whispered to Silvertongue.
Perhaps they had already gotten Dustfinger from the church. Perhaps he was in the cage they had set up, and he could whisper to him that they had brought his best friend, Fire, to save him. Night shadows filled many of the nooks and crannies among the houses, despite the brightness of the street lights. Farid was about to set off, using their shelter, when the door of Capricorn's house opened. The old woman with a face like a vulture came out. She was dragging Silvertongue's daughter along behind her. Farid hardly recognized Meggie in the long white dress she wore. After them, gun in hand, came the man who had shot at him and Silvertongue. He looked around, took a bunch of keys from his pocket, locked the door, and beckoned to one of the men standing outside the church. He was obviously telling him to guard the house. So only one man would stay on guard when the others went off to see the show. Farid felt Silvertongue tensing every muscle, as if he wanted to run to his daughter, who looked almost as pale as her dress. The boy clutched his arm in a warning gesture, but Silvertongue seemed to have forgotten him. He had eyes only for the girl. One reckless step, and he would be out of the shelter of the shadows.
"Don't!"
Farid pulled him back in alarm, as best he could, for he scarcely came up to Silvertongue's shoulder. Luckily, Capricorn's men were watching the old woman as she crossed the square, walking so fast the girl stumbled over the hem of her dress a couple of times.
"She looks so pale," whispered Silvertongue. "Heavens, do you see how frightened she is? Perhaps she'll look this way. Perhaps we can give her a signal."
"No," Farid was still hanging on to him with both hands. "We must start the fire. That's the only way we can help her. Please, Silvertongue. They'll see you."
"Don't keep calling me Silvertongue. It gets on my nerves."
The old woman disappeared among the houses with Meggie. Flatnose was following them, lumbering like a bear in a black suit, and at last the other men left too. They went down the street, laughing, looking forward to what the night promised them, death spiced with fear and the appearance of a new terror in this accursed village. Only the guard outside Capricorn's house was left. He watched the others go, his face gloomy as he kicked an empty cigarette packet and struck the wall with his fist. He was the only one who was going to miss the fun. Even the guard at the top of the church tower could at least watch the show from a distance. They had expected a guard to be posted outside the house. Farid had explained the best way to get rid of him, and Silvertongue had nodded and agreed to the plan. When the footsteps of Capricorn's men had died away, and they could hear nothing but the noise from the direction of the parking lot, they moved out of the shadows, acting as if they had only just emerged from the alley, and openly approached the guard side by side. He looked at them suspiciously, pushed himself away from the wall against which he had been leaning, and took the gun from his shoulder. Alarmed, Farid involuntarily put his hand to his forehead, but at least the guard was not one of the men who might have recognized them, not the man with the limp, or Basta, or any of Capricorn's other personal henchmen. "Hey, lend us a hand!" called Silvertongue, ignoring the gun. "Those fools forgot Capricorn's armchair. We've been sent to get it." The guard was holding his gun in front of his chest.
"Oh, for heaven's sake! That thing's so heavy it'd break your back. Where are you from?"
He scrutinized Silvertongue's face, as if trying to remember whether he had seen it before. He took no notice of Farid at all.
"You from the north, then? I heard you have a lot of fun up there."
"That's right." Silvertongue went so close to the guard that the man took a step back.
"Come on, you know Capricorn doesn't like to be kept waiting."
The guard nodded sullenly.
"Yes, yes, all right,"
he muttered, looking over to the church.
"There's no point in standing guard here anyway. What do they think will happen? Do they expect the Fire Eater to come and steal the gold? That fellow was always lily-livered. He'll be well away by now, he..."
But suddenly, while the guard was still looking at the church, Silvertongue seized the gun and hit him on the head with the butt. Then he dragged him around behind Capricorn's house, where it was pitch dark. "Did you hear what he said?" Farid had quickly gagged the guard and was expertly tying a rope around the man's legs. "Dustfinger must have escaped. He said, 'He'll be well away. He can't have meant anyone else.'"
"Yes, I heard. But my daughter is still here."
Silvertongue gave him the backpack and looked around, but the square was now so deserted and quiet, it was as if they were the only people left in Capricorn's village. Not a sound was heard from the guard up in the church tower. No doubt tonight he had eyes for nothing but the events taking place on the brightly lit football field. Farid took two torches and the bottle of inflammable liquid from Dustfinger's backpack. "He got away," he was thinking. "He got away." He could almost have laughed out loud. Silvertongue went back to Capricorn's house, peered into several windows, and finally knocked one of them in, taking off his jacket and pressing it against the glass to muffle the sound when it broke. Laughter and music drifted up from the parking lot. "The matches! I can't find them!" Farid rummaged among Dustfinger's things until Silvertongue took the backpack from his hand.
"Give it to me," he whispered. "You get the torches ready."
Farid did as he was told. He carefully soaked the cotton wool in the acrid-smelling spirits. "Dustfinger will come back," he thought. "He'll come back to look for Gwyn, and then he'll fetch me." Voices came from one of the alleys, men's voices. For a few terrible moments, they seemed to be coming closer, but they died away again, swallowed up by the music coming from the parking lot and filling the night like a foul smell. Silvertongue was still looking for the matches. "Ugh," he said, swearing softly and removing his hand from the backpack. Martin droppings were smeared over his thumb. He wiped them off on the nearest wall, put his hand in the pack again, and threw Farid a box of matches. Then he took something else out. The little book the Dustfinger kept in a side pocket he had sewn inside. Farid had often looked at it. It had pictures stuck in it. Cut-out pictures of fairies and witches, trolls and dragons, goblins, nymphs, and ancient trees. Silvertongue flicked through it while Farid was soaking the second torch. A photograph was lying between the pages. The photograph of Capricorn's maid, the woman who had tried to help Dustfinger and was to die for it tonight. Or had she escaped with him? Silvertongue was staring at the photograph, and suddenly it was as if nothing else in the world existed. "What's the matter?" Farid put the match to the dripping torch. The flame flared up, hissing and hungry. How beautiful it was. Farid licked his finger and passed it through the flame. Here, take this. He held the torch out to Silvertongue. It would be best for him, as the taller of them, to throw it through the window. But Silvertongue just stood there, gazing at the photo. That's the woman who helped Dustfinger, said Farid. The one they caught, too. I think he's in love with her. Here. Once again he held the burning torch out to Silvertongue. What are you waiting for? Silvertongue looked at him as if he had been woken from a dream. In love. In love. He murmured as he took the torch from Farid's hand. Then he put the photograph in the breast pocket of his shirt, cast another glance at the empty square, and threw the torch through the broken window into Capricorn's house.
Give me a leg up, I want to see it burning, cried Farid.
Silvertongue did as he asked. The room seemed to be some kind of office. Farid saw paper, a desk, a picture of Capricorn on the wall. Someone here could write, after all. The burning torch lay among the sheets of paper covered with writing. It licked and gulped, it whispered with delight at such a feast, flared up and leapt on from the desk to the curtains at the window. Greedily it consumed the dark fabric. The whole room was filled with red and yellow. Smoke billowed out of the broken window, stinging Farid's eyes. I must go. Silvertongue put him down abruptly. The music had stopped. Suddenly it was eerily quiet. Silvertongue ran off along the street leading down to the parking lot. Farid watched him go. He had something else to do. He waited until the flames were shooting out of the window. Then he began shouting,
Fire! Capricorn's house is on fire!
His voice echoed over the empty square. Heart thudding, he ran to the corner of the big house and looked up at the church tower. The guard there had leapt to his feet. Farid lit the second torch and threw it at the church porch. The air began to smell of smoke. The guard froze, turned, and, at last, he rang the bell. And Farid ran off to follow Silvertongue. Chapter 55 Treachery, Loose Talk, and Stupidity. Eleanor thought she was showing considerable courage. Of course, she still did not know exactly what fate awaited her, and if her niece knew more than she did, she hadn't told her, but she could be sure it would be nothing pleasant. Nor did Teresa give the men who came to take them up from the crypt the satisfaction of seeing her shed tears. She couldn't curse them or shout at them anyway. Her voice was gone, like a garment she no longer wore. Luckily, she had two pieces of paper with her, crumpled, dirty scraps, much too small for all the words unspoken over 9 years. She had filled the paper with tiny writing until there wasn't space for a single word more. She didn't want to say anything about herself and what had happened to her, and just waved Eleanor's whispered questions impatiently away. There were questions of her own she wanted to ask, question after question about her daughter and her husband. Eleanor whispered the answers into her ear, very quietly, so Basta, in the adjoining cell, would not realize that the two women who were about to die with him had known each other ever since the younger one had learned to walk, holding on to Eleanor's endless bookshelves. Basta was not in a good way. Whenever they looked at him, they saw his hands clinging to the bars, knuckles white under his suntanned skin. Once Eleanor thought she heard him weeping. But when they were taken out of their cells, his face was as vacant as a dead man's. And when their guards locked them up in that unspeakable cage, he crouched on the floor in a corner and sat as motionless as a doll that no one wants to play with. The cage smelled of dogs and raw meat, and indeed it did look like a kennel. Several of Capricorn's men ran the butts of their shotguns along the silvery grey bars before sitting down on the benches that had been made ready for them. Basta, in particular, was the object of enough scorn and derision for 10 men, and from his failure to react at all, one could only guess at the depths of his despair. All the same, Eleanor and Teresa kept as far away from him as they could in the same cage. They also kept away from the bars, from all the fingers poking through, the faces the men made at them, and the burning cigarettes flicked at them. They stood close together, both glad and sorry to be with each other. On the outskirts of the arena, right beside the entrance, and carefully segregated from the men, sat the women who worked for Capricorn. They showed none of the men's ghastly excitement. Most of their faces were downcast, but, again and again, their glances strayed over to Teresa with expressions of pity and dread. Capricorn arrived when the long benches were full. There were no seats for the boys, so they had squatted on the ground in front of the black jackets. His face emotionless, Capricorn strode past them all as if they were nothing but a flock of crows that had assembled at his command. Only in front of the cage containing his prisoners did he slow his pace to examine each of the three with a small, satisfied glance. For a fraction of a second, life came back into Basta as his former lord and master stopped by the bars. He raised his head, his eyes pleading silently, like a dog begging for forgiveness. But Capricorn walked on without a word. When he had seated himself in his black leather armchair, Cockerell placed himself behind it, legs planted wide apart. Obviously, he was the new favorite now. "For heaven's sake, stop looking at him like that!" Eleanor snapped at Basta when she realized his eyes were still following Capricorn. "He's planning to feed you to his friend like a fly to a frog, so how about a little indignation? You were always so ready with a choice selection of threats. I'll cut your tongue out, I'll slice you to pieces. What's happened to all that, then?" But Basta only bowed his head and stared at the floor beneath his boots. Eleanor thought he looked like an oyster, with the flesh and life sucked out of it. When Capricorn was sitting down, the blaring music fell silent, and they brought Maggie forward. They had put a horrible dress on her, but she held her head high, and the old woman, who they called the Magpie, had difficulty dragging her up onto the rostrum which the black jackets had set up in the middle of the field. A single chair stood on the rostrum, looking as forlorn as if someone had left it there and forgotten it. Eleanor thought a gallows and a rope would have looked more suitable. Maggie looked down at them as the Magpie forced her up the wooden steps. "Hello, darling," called Eleanor, when Maggie's frightened gaze recognized her. "Don't worry, I'm only here because I didn't want to miss hearing you read." Everything had fallen so still on Capricorn's arrival that her voice echoed over the whole arena. It sounded brave and fearless. Fortunately, no one could hear how hard her heart was hammering against her ribs. Nor did anyone notice that she was almost choking with fear, for Eleanor had put on her armor, the impenetrable and extremely useful armor behind which she had always hidden at times of need. It had become a little harder with every grief she felt, and lately there had been grief enough in Eleanor's life. One of the black jackets laughed at her words, and a faint smile even flitted over Maggie's face. Eleanor put her arm around Teresa's shoulders and held her close. "Look at your daughter," she whispered. "As brave as... She wanted to compare Maggie to a hero from some story, but all the heroes she could think of were men, and anyway none of them seemed to her brave enough for a comparison with the girl standing there, perfectly straight, scrutinizing Capricorn's black jackets with her chin jutting out defiantly. The Magpie had brought not only Maggie, but an old man. Eleanor guessed that this was the writer who had caused them so much trouble, Fenolio, the creator of Capricorn, Basta, and all the other monsters, including the terrible creature Maggie was to bring to life tonight. Eleanor had always thought more of books than their authors, and she looked at the old man without much goodwill as Flatnose led him past their cage. There was a seat ready for him only a little way from Capricorn's armchair. Eleanor wondered whether that meant Capricorn had found a new friend. But when Flatnose placed himself behind the grim-faced old man, she concluded that Fenolio was more likely a prisoner, too. Capricorn rose as soon as the old man was seated. Without a word, he let his gaze pass slowly over the long line of his men, as if recalling every one of them, remembering what good and what bad service each one had done him. The silence in the arena smelled of fear. All the laughter had died away, and not a whisper could be heard.
"There is no need," Capricorn finally began, raising his voice, "for me to explain to most of you why the three prisoners you see there are to be punished. For the rest, it is enough for me to say it is for treachery, loose talk, and stupidity. One may argue, of course, over whether or not stupidity is a crime deserving of death. I think it is, for it can have exactly the same consequences as treachery."
As he said this, there was a restless stir on the benches. At first, Eleanor thought Capricorn's words had set it off, but then she heard the bell. Even Basta raised his head as its tolling sounded through the night. At a sign from Capricorn, Flatnose beckoned to five men and strode off with them. Those left behind put their heads together uneasily, and some even jumped up and turned to look at the village. However, Capricorn raised his hand to quell the murmur that had arisen.
"It is nothing," he called in so loud and cutting a tone that everything immediately fell still again. "A fire, that's all. And we know how to deal with fire, don't we?"
There was laughter, but some of the crowd, both men and women, were still looking anxiously at the houses. So they'd done it. Eleanor bit her lips so hard they hurt. Mortimer and the boy had started a fire. No smoke yet showed over the rooftops, so, reassured, all the faces turned back to Capricorn, who was saying something about deceit and falsehood, discipline and negligence, but Eleanor only half heard him. She kept looking at the houses of the village, though she knew it was dangerous to do so.
"So much for the prisoners we have here," cried Capricorn. "Now for those who got away."
Cockerell picked up a sack that had been lying behind Capricorn's chair and gave it to him. Smiling, Capricorn put his hand into it and held something up. A piece of fabric from a shirt or dress, torn and blood-stained.
"They are dead," called Capricorn to his audience. "I'd rather have seen them here, of course, but unfortunately there was nothing for it. They were trying to escape and had to be shot. Well, no one will miss the treacherous little fire-eater. Almost all of you knew him, and fortunately Silvertongue has left us his daughter, who has inherited his gifts."
Teresa looked at Eleanor, her eyes glazed with horror.
"He's lying,"
Eleanor whispered to her, although she too could not take her eyes off the blood-stained rags.
"He's using my lies, my tricks. That's not blood. It's paint or some kind of dye."
But she saw her niece did not believe her. She believed in the blood-stained cloth, just as her daughter did. Eleanor could read this on Maggie's face, and she longed to call out to her that Capricorn was lying. But she wanted him to believe his own story for a little longer, to believe they were all dead, and that no one would come to disturb his festivities.
"That's right! Boast of a blood-stained rag, you miserable fire-raiser!" she shouted through the bars. "That's really something to be proud of! Why do you need another monster? You're all monsters, every one of you sitting there! You murder books, you abduct children!"
No one took any notice of her. A couple of the blackjackets laughed. Teresa moved closer to the bars, clutching their cold metal with her fingers, never taking her eyes off Maggie. Capricorn left the blood-stained fabric lying over the arm of his chair.
"I know that rag," thought Eleanor. "I've seen it somewhere before. They're not dead. Who else would have started the fire?" "The matchstick eater," something inside her whispered, but she refused to listen. "No,
The story must have a happy ending. It wouldn't be right otherwise.
She had never liked sad stories.
Chapter 56 The Shadow.
In books, hatred is often described as hot, but at Capricorn's festivities, Meggie discovered it was cold, an ice-cold hand that stops the heart and presses it like a clenched fist against the ribs. Hatred made her freeze, in spite of the mild air wafting around her, telling her that the world was a good, safe place. She knew it was not. As the bloody cloth on which the smiling Capricorn had laid his ringed hand showed all too clearly.
"Well, so much for that," he cried, "and now for the real reason we are all gathered here tonight. Not only are we about to punish the traitors, but we're also going to celebrate a reunion with an old friend. Some of you may remember him, and as for the others, I promise that once you have met him, you will never forget him."
Cockerell twisted his thin face into a sour smile. He was obviously not looking forward to the reunion, and at Capricorn's words, alarm showed on several other faces.
"But that's enough talking. Now, let's hear something read aloud to us."
Capricorn leaned back in his chair and nodded to the magpie. Mortala clapped her hands, and Darius came hurrying across the arena with the casket Meggie had last seen in the magpie's room. He clearly knew what it contained. His face was even more haggard than usual as he opened the casket and held it out to the magpie, his head bowed humbly. The snakes seemed to be drowsy, and this time Mortala did not put on a glove before she lifted them out. She even draped them over her shoulders while she took the book out of its hiding place. Then she put the snakes back as carefully as if they were precious jewels, closed the lid, and handed the casket back to Darius. He stayed on the rostrum, looking awkward. Meggie caught him looking sympathetically at her as the magpie made her sit down on the chair and placed the book on her lap. Here it was again, the unlucky thing in its brightly coloured paper jacket. What colour was the binding under it? Raising the dust jacket with her finger, Meggie saw the dark red cloth, as red as the flames surrounding the ink-black heart. Everything that had happened had begun between the pages of this book, and only the words of its author could save them now. Meggie stroked its binding as she always did before opening a book. She had seen Mo doing the same. Ever since she could remember, she had known that movement— the way he would pick up a book, stroke the binding almost tenderly, then open it as if he were opening a box full to the brim with precious things. Of course, the marvels you hoped to find might not be waiting inside the covers, so then you closed the book, sorry that its promise had not been kept. But Inkheart was not a book of that kind. Badly told stories never come to life. There are no dust fingers in them, nor even a Basta.
"I am told to tell you something." The magpie's dress smelled of musty lavender, its fragrance enveloping Meggie in a suffocating threat. "Should you fail to do what Capricorn asks, should it occur to you to stumble over the words on purpose or distort them so the guest Capricorn is expecting does not come, then..."
Mortala paused, and Meggie felt the old woman's breath on her cheek.
"Cockerel will cut the old man's throat. Capricorn may not give the order himself because he believes the stupid lies the old man told him, but I don't, and Cockerel will do as I say. Understand me, my little cherub."
She pinched Meggie's cheek with her bony fingers. Meggie shook off her hand and looked at Cockerel. He moved up behind Fenolio, smiled at her, and ran a finger across the old man's throat. Fenolio pushed him away and looked at Meggie as if one look could convey everything he wanted to say to her, and give her encouragement, comfort, and maybe even amusement in the face of all the horrors surrounding them. Whether or not their plan worked, depended on him and his words and Meggie's reading. Meggie felt the paper in her sleeve, scratching her skin. Her hands seemed like the hands of a stranger as she leafed through the pages of the book. The place where she was to begin was no longer marked by a folded corner. A bookmark as black as charred wood lay between the pages. "Push your hair back from your forehead," Fenoglio had told her. "That will be the signal to me." But just as she raised her left hand, the crowd on the benches became restless again. Flatnose was back, with soot marks on his face. He hurried to Capricorn's side and whispered something to him. Capricorn frowned and looked toward the houses. Now Meggie saw two plumes of smoke rising into the sky from behind and beside the church tower. Capricorn rose quickly from his chair. He tried to sound composed, ironic, like a man amused at some childish prank. But his face told a different story.
"I am sorry to have to spoil the fun for a few more of you, but tonight the red rooster is crowing here, too. A feeble little rooster, but its neck must be wrung all the same. Flatnose, take another 10 men back with you."
Flatnose obeyed and marched off with his reinforcements. The benches now looked a good deal emptier.
"And don't any of you show your faces back here before you've found the fire-raiser," Capricorn called after them. "Whoever it is, we'll teach him not to start fires in the devil's own domain. We'll teach him a lesson right here and now."
Someone laughed, but most of those who had stayed behind were looking uneasily in the direction of the village. Some of the maids had actually risen to their feet, but the magpie called their names in a sharp voice, and they were quick to sit back down with the others, like schoolchildren unfairly slapped on the hand. Nonetheless, the restlessness persisted. Scarcely anyone was looking at Meggie. Almost all the members of her audience had turned their backs to her and were pointing at the smoke and whispering to one another. A red glow was creeping up the church tower, and grey smoke formed a dense cloud above the rooftops.
"What is all this? Why are you staring at that little wisp of smoke?"
There was no missing the anger in Capricorn's voice now. "A bit of smoke, a few flames. So what?
Are you going to let that spoil our festivities? Fire is our best friend. Have you forgotten?"
Meggie saw the doubting faces turn back toward him. Then she heard a name. Dustfinger. A woman's voice had called it out.
"What does that mean?"
Capricorn's voice was so sharp that Darius almost dropped the casket of snakes.
"There is no Dustfinger anymore. He's lying up there in the hills with his mouth full of earth, and that marten of his on his breast. I never want to hear his name again. He is forgotten, as if he had never been."
"That's not true!"
Meggie's voice rang out over the arena so loud and clear that she herself was alarmed.
"He's here!"
She held up the book.
"Never mind what you do to him. Everyone who reads this story will see him. You can even hear his voice and see the way he laughs and breathes fire."
All went perfectly quiet. A few feet scraped uneasily on the red, rough surface of the old football field. Then suddenly, Meggie heard something behind her. It was a ticking, like the sound of a clock, yet not quite the same. It sounded like a human tongue imitating a clock. Tick, 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 tick. The sound was coming from among the cars parked behind the wire fence with their dazzling headlights on. Meggie couldn't help it. She looked around, in spite of the magpie and all the suspicious eyes turned on her. She could have kicked herself for being so stupid. Suppose they had seen it too, the thin figure rising among the cars and quickly ducking down again. But no one seemed to have noticed her glance any more than the ticking.
"A very fine speech," said Capricorn slowly, "but you're not here to make funeral orations for dead traitors. You're here to read aloud, and I am not going to tell you so again."
Maggie forced herself to look at Capricorn. She mustn't look at the cars again. Suppose that really had been Farid. Suppose she hadn't imagined the ticking. The magpie was watching her suspiciously. Perhaps she had heard it too, that soft, harmless ticking. Nothing but a tongue clicking against someone's teeth. What did it mean? Unless you knew the story of Captain Hook and his fear of the crocodile with the ticking clock inside it. The magpie wouldn't have read it, but Mo knew Maggie would understand his signal. He had woken her up often enough with that ticking sound right beside her ear, so close that it tickled. "Breakfast time, Maggie," he used to whisper. "The crocodile's here." That was it. Mo knew she would recognize the ticking that helped Peter Pan to go aboard Captain Hook's ship and rescue Wendy. He couldn't have given her a better signal. Wendy, thought Maggie. What had happened next? For a moment, she almost forgot where she was, but the magpie reminded her. She slapped Maggie's face with the flat of her hand. "Start reading, will you, little witch?" she hissed. And so Maggie obeyed. Hastily, she removed the black bookmark from the pages where it lay. She must hurry. She must read before Mo did anything silly. He didn't know what she and Fenolia were planning to do.
"I'm going to start now, and I don't want anyone disturbing me," she cried. "Anyone! Is that understood?"
"Oh, please, Mo, understand," she thought. "Please." A few of Capricorn's remaining men laughed, but Capricorn himself leaned back and folded his arms in anticipation.
"Yes, just you take heed of what the girl said," he called. "Anyone who disturbs her will be given to the Shadow to welcome him here."
Maggie put two fingers up her sleeve. There they were, Fenolia's words. She looked at the magpie.
"Well, she's disturbing me," she said out loud. "I can't read with her standing so close behind me."
Capricorn gestured impatiently to the magpie. Mortula's face looked sour, as if he had told her to eat a bar of soap, but she took two or three reluctant steps back. That would have to do. Maggie raised her hand and pushed the hair back from her forehead. The signal for Fenolio. He instantly launched into his performance.
"No, no, no! She's not to read!" he cried, moving toward Capricorn before Cockerel could stop him. "I can't allow it! I am the author of this story, and I didn't write it to be misused for the purposes of violence and murder!"
Cockerel tried to put his hand over Fenolio's mouth, but Fenolio bit his fingers and sidestepped him with more agility than Maggie would ever have expected of the old man.
"I invented you," he bellowed as Cockerel chased him around Capricorn's chair, "and I'm sorry I did, you stinking devil of a villain."
Then he ran off. Cockerel didn't catch up with Fenolio until he reached the cage containing the prisoners, and in revenge for the mockery and laughter coming from the benches, he twisted the old man's arm behind his back so viciously that Fenolio let out a cry of pain. Yet when Cockerel dragged him back to Capricorn's side, Fenolio was looking pleased, because he knew he had given Maggie plenty of time. They had rehearsed it often enough. Her fingers had been shaking as she took the sheet of paper out of her sleeve, but no one noticed anything when she slipped it into the pages of the book, not even the magpie.
"How the old man boasts," cried Capricorn. "Do I look as if an old fellow like that invented me?"
There was more laughter. The smoke above the rooftop seemed to have been forgotten. Cockerel put his hand over Fenolio's mouth.
"Once again, and I hope this will be the last time," said Capricorn to Maggie, "start reading. The prisoners have waited long enough for their executioner."
Silence fell again, and once more it smelled of fear. Maggie bent over the book on her lap. The letters seemed to dance on the pages. "Come out," thought Maggie. "Come out and save us. Save us all. Eleanor and my mother, Mo and Farid. Save Dustfinger if he's still alive. And save Bastard, too, for all I care." Her tongue felt like a little animal that had found refuge in her mouth and was now butting its head against her teeth.
"Capricorn had many men," she began, "and every one of them was feared in the surrounding towns and villages. They stank of cold smoke, they stank of sulphur, and everything that reminds you of fire. Whenever one of them passed by, people closed their doors and hid under the stairs with their children. They called them Fire Fingers and Bloodhounds. Capricorn's men had many names. They were feared by day, and by night they made their way into dreams and poisoned them. But there was one who was feared even more than Capricorn's villains." Maggie felt as if her voice was growing stronger with every word she read. It seemed to grow until it filled the arena. "Folk called him the Shadow." Two more lines at the bottom of the page, then turn it over. Fenolio's words were waiting.
"Look at this, Maggie," he had whispered when he showed her the sheet of paper. "What an artist I am, eh? Is there anything in the world better than words on the page? Magic signs, the voices of the dead, building blocks to make wonderful worlds better than this one, comforters, companions in loneliness, keepers of secrets, speakers of the truth. All those glorious words." "Taste every word, Maggie," whispered Mo's voice inside her. "Savor it on your tongue. Do you taste the colors? Do you taste the wind and the night, the fear and the joy and the love? Taste them, Maggie, and everything will come to life."
"Folk called him Capricorn's Shadow." How the hissed as it passed her lips, how darkly the sound of the O formed in her mouth. "He came only when Capricorn called him," she read. "Sometimes he was red as fire, sometimes grey as the ash to which fire turns all that it devours. He darted out of the earth as fast as flames lick their way upward. His fingers and even his breath brought death. He rose before his master's feet, soundless, faceless, scenting his way like a hound on the trail and waiting for his master to point to the victim. It was said that Capricorn had commanded one of the trolls who understand the whole art of fire and smoke to create the shadow from the ashes of his victims. No one was sure, for it was also said that Capricorn had ordered those who called the shadow to life to be killed. All that everyone knew was that he was immortal, invulnerable, and pitiless, like his master." Maggie's voice died away, as if the wind had blown it from her lips. Something was rising from the gravel that covered the football field. It grew taller. It stretched its ashen limbs. The night air suddenly stank of sulphur. That stench burned Maggie's eyes so that the letters blurred, but she must go on reading while the eerie creature grew taller and taller. "Yet one night, a mild and starlit night, the shadow heard not Capricorn's voice when it was called forth, but the voice of a girl. And when she called his name, he remembered. He remembered all those from whose ashes he was made, all the pain and all the grief." The magpie reached over Maggie's shoulder. "What's this? What are you reading?" But Maggie jumped up and backed away before the old woman could snatch the sheet of paper from her. "He remembered," she read on in a loud, clear voice, "and he was determined to be avenged, avenged upon those who were the cause of all this misfortune, whose cruelty poisoned the whole world."
"Make her stop."
Was that Capricorn's voice? Maggie almost fell off the rostrum as she tried to keep away from the magpie. Darius stood there staring at her in astonishment, the casket in his hands. Then suddenly, but deliberately, as if he had all the time in the world, he put down the casket and wrapped his thin arms firmly around the magpie from behind. Nor did he let go, no matter how hard she struggled and cursed. And Maggie read on as the shadow stood watching her. The figure had no face, that was true. But it had eyes, terrible eyes, red as the embers of a hidden fire.
"Get the book away from her!"
shouted Capricorn. He was standing in front of his chair, bent double as if he feared his legs would refuse to obey him if he took so much as a step toward the shadow.
"Get it away from her!"
But none of his remaining men moved. None of the boys and none of the women came to his aid. They had eyes for nothing but the shadow as he stood there listening to Meggie's voice, as if she were telling him a long-forgotten tale.
"Indeed, he wanted revenge,"
Meggie read on. If only her voice weren't shaking so much, but it wasn't easy to kill, even if someone else was going to do it for her.
"So the shadow went to his master and reached out to him with ashen hands."
How soundlessly it moved, that terrible, gigantic figure. Meggie stared at Fenolio's next sentence.
"And Capricorn fell down on his face, and his black heart stopped beating?"
She couldn't say it. She couldn't. It had all been in vain. Then, suddenly, someone else was standing behind her. She hadn't even noticed him climbing up onto the rostrum. The boy was there too, holding a shotgun aimed at the benches, but no one sitting there stirred. No one so much as lifted a finger to save Capricorn. And Mo took the book from Meggie's hands, ran his eyes over the lines Fenolio had added, and in a firm voice read to the end of what the old man had written. "And Capricorn fell down on his face, and his black heart stopped beating, and all those who had gone burning and murdering with him disappeared, blown away like ashes in the wind." Chapter 57 A Deserted Village. So Capricorn died, just as Fenolio had written, and Cockerel disappeared at the same moment his master fell to the ground, and with him more than half the men on the benches. The rest ran away, all of them, the boys and women too. Those heading toward the village met some of Capricorn's men running back from extinguishing the fire. Their faces were smeared with soot and full of horror, and not because of the flames that had been licking around Capricorn's house, for they had put those out. No. They had seen Flatnose and several other men vanish into thin air before their very eyes. They were gone, as if the darkness had swallowed them up, as if they had never existed. And perhaps that was the truth of it. The man who had made them had now destroyed them, erased them like mistakes in a drawing, like marks on white paper. They were gone, and the others, the men who had not been born of Fenolio's words, were hurrying back to tell Capricorn what had happened, but Capricorn lay on his face, with gravel clinging to his red suit, and never again would anyone tell him anything about fire and smoke, about fear and death. Never again. Only the shadow still stood there, a figure so tall that the men running across the parking lot saw him from afar, grey before the black night sky, his eyes two blazing red stars, and they forgot the master they had been going to serve. Every one of them ran for the cars. They wanted only to get away, far away, before the being who had been summoned like a dog turned and devoured them all. Meggie did not come to her senses properly until they had all gone. She had nestled her head under Mo's arm, as she always did when she simply didn't want to see the world. Mo put the book under the jacket, which had almost made him look like one of Capricorn's henchmen, and he held her tight while all about them people were running and screaming. Only the shadow stood perfectly still, as if killing his master had sapped all his power.
"Farid," Meggie heard Mo say, "can you get that cage open?"
Only then did she bring her head out from under Mo's arm and see that the magpie was still there. Why hadn't she disappeared too? Darius was still holding on to her as if he was afraid of what would happen if he let go. But she was no longer kicking and struggling. She was just looking at Capricorn, with tears running down her sharp-boned face over her small, soft chin and falling like rain onto her dress. Agile as Gwyn, Farid jumped down from the rostrum and ran over to the cage without once taking his eyes off the shadow. However, the shadow just stood there, motionless, as if he would never move again.
"Meggy,"
whispered Mo,
"let's go over to the prisoners, shall we?
Poor Eleanor looks exhausted, and there's someone else I want to introduce to you." Farid was already busy with the door of the cage, but the two women inside were watching them.
"You don't need to introduce her," said Maggie, squeezing his hand. "I know who she is. I've known for ages. I wanted so much to tell you, but you weren't here. And now there's something else we have to read first. The last few sentences."
She took the book out from under Mo's jacket and leafed through it until she found Fenolio's sheet of paper still among the pages.
"He wrote them on the other side. There wasn't any space left on the first page," she said. "He just can't make his handwriting small."
"Fenolio." Maggie lowered the sheet of paper and looked around, searching for him, but she couldn't see him anywhere. Had Capricorn's men taken him with them, or...
"Mo, he's gone," she said, dismayed.
"I'll go and look for him in a moment," Mo reassured her. "But now read the rest, quick. Or should I do it?"
"No, I will."
The shadow was beginning to move again. He took a step toward the dead Capricorn, staggered back, and turned as clumsily as a dancing bear. Maggie thought she heard a groan. Farid ducked down behind the cage when the red eyes looked his way. Her mother and Eleanor flinched too, but Maggie read in a firm voice.
"There stood the shadow, and his memories hurt so much they almost tore him apart. He heard them in his head, all those screams and sighs. He thought he could feel tears on his grey skin. Their fear burned his eyes like smoke. Then, quite suddenly, he felt something different, something that made him shudder and forced him to his knees. Then his whole terrible figure disintegrated, and suddenly they were all back again, all the beings from whose ashes the shadow had been made, men, women and children, dogs and cats, goblins, fairies, and many more as well. Maggie saw the arena filling up with them. More and more of them were gathering in a throng where the shadow had collapsed, all looking around as if they'd just woken from a deep sleep. She read Fenolio's last sentence. "They woke as if from a bad dream, and, at last, everything was all right again."
"He isn't here any more," said Maggie, when Mo took Fenolio's sheet of paper from her and put it back in the book.
"Fenolio's gone, Mo. He's in the story now. I know he is."
Mo looked at the book and tucked it back under his jacket.
"Yes, I think you're right," he said. "But if so, there's nothing we can do about it for the moment. Perhaps the story now goes on beyond the book."
He led Maggie away with him, down from the rostrum, past all the people and the strange creatures crowding into the arena outside Capricorn's village, as if they had always been there. Darius followed them. He had finally let go of the magpie, who was now standing, with her bony hands gripping the back of the chair where Maggie had been sitting. She was weeping soundlessly, her face crumpled as if her whole being were made of tears. A tiny, blue-skinned fairy apologized profusely when it fluttered into Maggie's hair as she and Mo went toward the cage containing her mother and Eleanor. Then a shaggy creature, who looked half-human, half-animal, stumbled across her path, and finally she almost stepped on a tiny little man, who seemed to be made entirely of glass. Capricorn's village had acquired some strange new inhabitants. Farid was still trying to get the lock open when they reached the cage. He was picking at it, looking angry, and muttering something to the effect that Dustfinger had shown him just how to do it, and this must be a very special sort of lock.
"Oh, wonderful," said Eleanor sarcastically, pressing her face to the bars from inside. "So that shadow didn't eat us after all, but we'll be left to starve in a cage. Well, well. What do you think of your daughter, Mo? Isn't she a brave little thing?
I couldn't have uttered a word myself, not a single word. My God, my heart almost stopped when that old woman tried to get the book away from her.
Mo put his hand on Maggie's shoulder and smiled. But he was looking at someone else. 9 years is a long, long time.